This is Audible.
Symphony Space is pleased to present Thalia Book Club, The Lover, by Marguerite Duras, in conversation with Catherine Lacey, Akhil Sharma, Francois Mouly, and Kate Zimbrino, with selections read by Catherine Chalfant.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome to the Thalia Book Club. This season we have had a discussion of Madame Bovary and Sebald's The Rings of Saturn. And when we realized that 2015 was a big anniversary, the 30th anniversary for the publication in English of Marguerite Duras' The Lover, we thought it was a wonderful occasion to have a discussion among interesting writers and artists about this book. Duras was born in Saigon in 1914 and spent much of her childhood in French colonial Indochina, from which she drew deeply for her fiction. The Lover, her mesmerizing semi-autobiographical novel, tells of a French teenage girl's love affair with a Chinese man in his 20s, and obviously is about much more than that, and we'll be hearing about that. To lead our exploration of Duras tonight, we have four terrific writers and artists. Catherine Lacey, to my far left, is the author of Nobody Is Ever Missing, which was a finalist for the NYPL's Young Lions Fiction Award, and her forthcoming novel is titled The End of Uncertainty. Françoise Mouly has been the art editor at The New Yorker since 1993. She was the founder, publisher, designer, and co-editor with her husband, Art Spiegelman, of Raw Magazine. And she also launched the award-winning Toon Books and Toon Graphics, where she's an editorial director and designer. Akhil Sharma is the author of Family Life, which was awarded the 2015 Folio Prize for Fiction and named one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times and New York Magazine, and his first novel, An Obedient Father, won the Penn Hemingway Award. Kate Zimbrino is the author of the essay collection Heroines and the novel Green Girl, and her newest novel is forthcoming. So that is our distinguished group. But before they begin their conversation, the terrific stage and screen actress Kathleen Chalfant will read the beginning pages of the book to get your mind into that world. Kathleen is about to start shooting the second season of The Affair, and she asked me to mention that she will be starring in a one-woman show about the life of Rose Kennedy in the fall, so look out for that. And please enjoy. Thanks for coming.
So I've been instructed to begin this process of each of us talking about the first time we read The Lover and then again about the most recent time that we read The Lover. The first time I read it, I was only a couple years ago, and I was recommended it by someone that was like 22, and she just was very insistent that I read the book. So I did, and she kind of had explained it to me as about a woman sort of coming of age and sort of discovering a part of herself and discovering desire. So I read it kind of with that anticipation. And I guess I read it the first time sort of finding that. And also a lot more, but I had it in my mind just sort of checked off as like this coming of age story. But reading it for the second time, I was struck so much by the depth of her perspective that it's so much not about a 15-year-old, but more about a woman in later life thinking about herself at 15 and sort of the distance actually is, to me, so much more the focus of the book than the actual events that happen when she's a teenager. So I think that's enough from me. And someone else should say something now.
Well, the first time I read it, I actually don't remember. It was in the 80s. It was published in 84 in France and 85 in America. And I remember the book jacket because it was done by Louise Feely, and it was a very nice script. And I think I waited to pick it up when I was in Paris, because I remember reading Marguerite Duras much before that. I'm really, really old. So my vivid memories are reading her and her books when I was like 15 and 16 in Paris, because I liked pretty much all of the writers that were part of that group of Le Nouveau Roman. But what I was really smitten by was everything that was happening at that time. But certainly Le Nouveau Roman was Nathalie Sarraute, Michel Butor, Claude Simon, Alain Robbe-Grillet. And all of those books were really exciting to me. Marguerite Duras was older than a lot of the other writers, and I love the Ravissement de Lord Stein, you know, other books that she had written. I wasn't that taken by Hiroshima Mon Amour, which was her claim to fame, but I was really surprised years afterwards when I was in America that she became so well known and so well read with that book, with L'Amant. And what has been fantastic ever since is to see the evolution. She is somebody, like a lot of those other writers, that was intent on reinventing what novels could be and what memoirs could be and what can narrative could be. And she reinvented herself so many times that it's a delight to be here so many years later with writers that are somehow finding something in her books that could still be so relevant and that it can reach so far.
I also don't remember the first time I read the book. I'm not sure. I mean, the first time I knew of The Lover was when I went to see the movie. And largely I went to see the movie hoping for nudity. And so I don't know whether my memories of the movie are confused with when I read it either for the first time or again last week. And when I began reading it again last week, I found myself challenged by the book in that it wasn't what I would, for me, you know, much of my, I've written a book that is sort of a memoir, remembering, or a book that draws heavily from my own life. And I've had experiences that are very similar to the experiences of Marguerite Duras. I, for example, when I was 15, began going out with a much older woman. And so for me, I was very curious to read it to see how she processed these things and how she was using them. And I found myself regularly feeling that she was... first of all, I found the sentences challenging. That is... unnecessarily vague, unnecessarily hazy. So, for example, at the very beginning, you know, one day I was already old. In the entrance of a public place, a man came up to me, and it's a sentence that is enigmatic due to grammar and due to awkwardness. It isn't enigmatic through something earned, at least for me. At least that was my experience reading it. And then when I read, I often think of the image only I can see now and of which I've never spoken. And again, this sort of weird enigmatic language, which to me feels unearned, or it felt unearned the first time I was reading it. And so I'm reading this book, and the things that strike me as very moving and very true are odd details about the family, all these the minor stuff, stuff that's occurring almost to the side, are the things that interest me relative to the main story. And I find this, so the novel is for an older person looking back to this affair that she had when she was 15. And it's weird because it doesn't feel like, when I look back, as I imagine many of you look back upon affairs you had when you were children, your first boyfriends and first loves, you know, to me, this voice, the voice doesn't have the, isn't bringing that level of sort of wisdom to those things. And I'm not sure, oftentimes I'm reading this thing and I'm reading the book and I'm not sure what to take away from it. So for example, the very end of the book has the lover reappearing and telling the older, the young girl who's now older, that I love you, I've always loved you. And I wonder, is this the sort of thing a guy says to a former lover hoping I can get into her pants again? Because that's the sort of thing that normally men do, you know, they're dogs. And to the, I mean, because that's sort of a basic aspect of human nature, it needs to be handled in some way. That knowledge, that understanding has to be presented, managed by the author in some way. And it isn't being, and I as a reader am left unsure whether that reality is being acknowledged. So I read this thing last week, and then I read it again today. And the second time, just because I had read it recently, a lot of stuff made sense that had not made sense. So for example, she refers to other books she's written, and I had no idea what she was talking about, you know, in the first time I read this thing, read the book. And again, what I was left with was just a lot, the really sad stuff in the book is just hinted at and not really addressed. Or the really wonderful things. You know, she spends a lot of time talking about her brother and her family. But she mentions offhandedly that her husband had been arrested by the Nazis and she'd saved all her ration of sugar and rice for him. And, you know, that much love and tenderness, that's incredibly powerful, you know? And so it's almost like an equal thing, equal to the relationship of the parents, of the family. And that is really only tangentially addressed. And so to me, it doesn't feel to me like an older person looking back with the wisdom of age upon these things that had occurred. So for me, it was an interesting book to read. It was an interesting book to read.
Lots to talk about, but I don't remember. I've read The Lover now so many times. I don't remember when I first read it. I do know it was the first Duras book that I ever read. I think I also saw the film first. I believe I read it first when I wanted to be a writer, but I hadn't yet attempted to try to write. And my desire to be a writer had something to do with the bewilderment of childhood, which is perhaps maybe why I had such an intense connection to the text, which is so much about questioning how to write childhood. I do remember, you know, the intense, inerasable impression reading the book had on me the first time I read it, and every time I've read it since then, I feel like I've gone deeper into the text. I think when I first read it, I thought it was quite erotic, and I was very interested in the passionate despair between the two figures. But then slowly, as I began to read it over the years, I began to think more of the text as being a tragic romance about the family, with the mother being the real figure of the beloved in the novel. And then just really in the past couple of years, you know, I read it again this summer. I read it, I read it really probably once a year. I read it again today. I'm really just so entranced with the magic that she pulls off in this novel, the raw vulnerability of the work, the extreme intimacy of the work, the opening of the novel, this open, ravaged face, the memories playing like a film of one's childhood, of this 15 and a half year old girl crossing the river. And it's recently too, as I've begun to think about the book more seriously, I'm really compelled by the richness of the despair and melancholy over the world she's conjuring in this novel, the despair over class, over gender, over race, over age. And reading it today, I'm really just so struck by how this is such an intimate book, but also somehow such a deeply political one.
Yeah, I actually, it's so much about power. It's so much more about power than the first time I read it as well. Love is a kind of a form of an exchange of power, and so that's maybe the sexiest aspect of the book in its investigation of power exchange, power dynamics. But you know, she has a kind of power of beauty over the older lover. She also has a power of beauty over her own mother, but her mother has all this power over her. Then the brothers kind of have this a separate sort of structure of power in their relationship in the family. And then there's race and there's colonialism and there's class and there's money. And like, it comes at you from every single angle to the point where I can't believe somebody actually lived this sometimes, that it actually was just someone's life. And then at the same time, it asks so much trust of you. It's such an intimate sort of small personal voice that it's asking you to kind of like, know all of that, forget all of that, and like come down to its level and just like listen.
I think, you know, Marguerite Duras would be so delighted by your response, Akhil. She would just love every word that you used to, you know, describe your reaction to the book. At some point in an interview, I think in the Nouvelle Ops, she said, in French, because it's, but I'll translate in English. She said, L'amant, c'est de la merde. C'est un roman de gare. Je l'ai écrit quand j'étais saoule. She said, this book is shit. It's train station literature. I wrote it when I was drunk.
You really get the sense. I mean, Eva Talvanel talks about Duras the lover, and she calls the work, Duras' later work, her alcoholizations. And you really get, it's saturated with just her alcoholizations.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you really get the sense of this woman in the silence of the night, really drunk. And it's saturated with that sense of drunkenness.
And everything you said is in that book. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. And everything you saw is in that book as well. And I think that's what she was trying to do, to rewrite, to reinvent literature in such a way that it could be read in such completely different set of interpretations. There's another quote by her which, because she did this thing of rewriting the same story over and over again. She first wrote it in Le Barrage contre le Pacifique, where she's talking about many of her books have to do with autobiographical elements of her life. And she, there's many different things that she goes back to, but certainly her relationship with her mother, her relationship with her two brothers, her relationship when she's 15 with a Chinese man. When it was being turned into a movie, she was at first hired to be the script writer for it, and then she got so angry with the writer because he was trying to make it his movie rather than her version of the movie that she demanded that he takes her name off of the credit. And she wrote another book called L'Amant de la Chine du Nord, which is basically another version of the stories. That's when she's saying, this one is no good, so when you're using as a script, in which she goes into the same kind of factual narrative, but with completely different points of view and different anecdotes as well.
That's what I find really intriguing about the voice and language, is its vagueness. I mean, not only was she writing in this sort of vague type of literature, the nouveau roman, but to me, it's the awkward and exhausted quality of the language, this idea that she's written this story over and over again, and so the question is, how does one write childhood? How does one write a story with no center to it? So for me, this is such a stripped down text, almost as if, yes, she's written this before, she's written the facts before, and it's something about the feeling of memory, the longing towards these women she's remembering. And there's so much of The Lover that's really about these friends, these women, these exiles, her mother. So it's more about the repetition of these memories, like a film, and the feeling of them, more than any sort of specificity.
But that was the goal of the nouveau roman and of many of those writers, was to write subjectively. And I mean, in French, I don't think anybody would talk about vagueness in her language. And I think there is an issue of translation, because she writes French as if it was English. And I wonder, like Le Ravissement de Lolle Stein, whether that last name Stein, whether she actually is alluding to Gertrude Stein, that she has some interest in that, in the use of language as declarative.
There's a simplicity and a repetition to the
language. Minimalist, yeah. And the sentences that you're saying are ungrammatical and unsyntactical are actually, she, like a lot of the other nouveau roman writers, eschews punctuation. And I checked a couple of things, and it seems that in English they reintroduce some punctuation, whereas she has run-on sentences in French, which doesn't change the basic feeling, which is you are really, when you're reading, feel like you are in the inside of her head. And, you know, she's jumping from one thing to another, and she starts talking about the lover, but then she's bringing something about her mother, and then she talks about writing, and then she... It has a lot of that feeling of stream of consciousness.
And it's a meditation on memory and how memory works.
Yeah, there's one sentence by her that I wrote down. It was also on the topic of this book and all the different versions. And she says, "La mémoire n'est pas une réalité reconstruite, mais plutôt un geste, une imagination," which means memory is not a reconstruction of reality, but it's rather a gesture, an imagination. And, you know, to call it a gesture and imagination, those two things are syntactically not correct, but they ring true.
I mean, I think for me, the issue is not grammar. The issue is, first of all, I mean, we can't talk about what this thing is in French, because all we can talk about is this book here in front of us. For all I know, you know, she reads like Tolstoy in French. I mean, I have no idea, right?
More like Camus.
Yeah, but I have no idea. All I can talk about is the language that I have in front of me, right? So my issue is not with grammar, right? My issue is really that the enigma appears unearned.
What would a writer have to do to earn enigma? Or, and I mean, not to put you on the spot, but I'm gonna actually just put you on the spot. But I mean, the vagueness and the kind of intimacy and the strangeness of the language and the backwardsness.
The opening of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, right? Let us go then, you and I, with the evening spread out against the sky, you know, like a patient etherized upon a table. You know, so that is enigmatic, right? And it's beautiful. And it's also very sort of detailed and practical. So everything is feeding off each other. So that is one example of earned enigma.
The book to me in the English translation, I mean, it's the sense of the repetition, it's the rupture between the fragments, but, you know, the passage that was read so beautifully by Catherine, you know, what happens there is silence, the slow travail of my whole life. I'm still there watching those possessed children, as far away from the mystery now as I was then. I've never written, though I thought I wrote. Never loved, though I thought I loved. Never done anything but wait outside the closed door. To me, I mean, that's magical. You know.
Agreed.
I think, in a way, the demonstration of what she is very successful at is leaving the language open to interpretation.
It is all about that gesture of openness.
And I think she does step away from the position of the writer as the imperial person who has the knowledge and is trying to like narrowly channel it toward you with a recipient by engaging in a dialogue with her reader. And she's very vulnerable. She puts herself on the line. I think it is true that a lot of the most emotionally powerful things she talks about, she talks about her love and her hate for her mother and for her brother, as well as the pleasure and the fear and the disgust with her lover. All of this, she uses minimalism as a way of sketching out in the most implied way to leave the reader in.
Well, I feel like it's complicated to try and talk about intent with a book like this, because the whole thing sort of feels accidental, which I think is what Akil is kind of maybe bristling against, is that there's not as much crafting of it. There's not even maybe as much of a consideration for a reader. It's more just, I have this sense, and maybe it's not true, but I have this sense that she sat down and just wrote the whole thing.
It says at the end, I kept on counting on my fingers, it says January through... it says, what does it say? January through March?
February through May, 1984.
February, March, April, May. I mean, she wrote it in 4 months.
Yeah, but if we're talking about February 1st through May 30th.
Yeah, and it's not...
maybe 3 months.
It's not in isolation. I mean, the book doesn't exist in isolation for her or for people who are interested in her work, because they all echo each other.
There's echoes, and, you know, Helene Cixous writes about her work, you know, the archives of my writing exist within my writing. And I think, to me, she is referring to her past as a... I mean, this is such a work about being a writer, and this is such a work about writing this text of the family, essentially the text of her identity over and over again. And the quality I get the most when I've read it today is not craft, although to me, I see a writer at the height of her powers. There's a minimalism as well as an excessiveness somehow. But the word that came to my mind when I was reading it today is, it's like it's purified. You know, this aspect that that has a very spiritual connotation, but there is this idea that it's that she's gone to this almost pure place when she's writing it.
Well, I mean, she's kind of writing it from like the edge of her writing career, from a further edge of it. And it is so much about departure and death and just looking back and in a way that I think a younger writer couldn't do. You know, I think it's so odd that this is a book that I've suggested to a lot of students that I know a lot of younger friends that have read and read. I feel like we read it often when we're young, but it's almost in a kind of like, you can't really know what she's talking about as a younger person, as a younger writer. I feel like it can only be written, this type of a book can really only be written when a writer has had a whole career, has this sort of sense of narrative in their blood, to the point where they don't have to craft as much anymore, and it's coming out naturally, but almost in a kind of bones sort of way. I'm not sure how else to describe it.
Although it's interesting that Derrida is a lover, and Derrida is this huge influence on so many contemporary younger writers, and I keep on seeing references it to everywhere. And in Valeria Lucielli's essay collection, she's this wonderful Mexican writer who published a translation of her essay collection on Coffee House Press. There's kind of a joke in her essay collection that she had this friend in her 20s who was obsessed with the lover and kept on talking about her ravaged face. You know, so there is this, Maggie Nelson in Bluett brings up the ravaged face. I just read a collection by a friend that brings up Derrida. So it is this. There is something in
what
terms
is it about that opening passage that young women everywhere face. Are like, the ravaged face?
Well, I love my favorite part of the book reading at this time is she talks about writing, how writing, this is essentially a self-portrait, like a woman's looking in the mirror in the middle of the night. She's saying writing should not be advertisement, that every book needs to come out of the vanity and the void. And the fact that she writes vanity, I think, is very compelling.
Well, I think she deals with topics in that first opening paragraph that was read so well tonight. She talks about that sense of self that you have as a young woman when you are 15, 16, 17, and then the world comes crashing down on you, and then you lose any sense. And she is someone who obviously contended with death and with suicide, survived an induced coma, was an alcoholic where she tried to, she said like she was drinking to kill herself, and really has a strong fascination with losing herself and building herself. And there is something, I think, very evocative for a young woman, I can't tell for a young man, but for a young woman, about that sense of recognition that you lose. And she says she lost it at 19, which is the moment she arrived in France, because she grew up in Saigon and then was sent to Paris after a baccalaureate. And she's also somebody who, when she's 12 and 13, which is a moment where her family life is extremely difficult because her father died when she was 7, and then she left with a mother that can't collect the pension. Her mother was also a teacher, but she can't collect the pension from the French government, so they're stuck in what's at the time called Indochine. And the mom invests all of the money she has in this mad scheme of buying land where she's going to grow rice with those three young kids. And what nobody tells her is that when you're buying land in this administrated province, you're supposed to give kickbacks to get the good land. So she puts all of her money into a land that actually gets flooded every single year, and it's completely unusable because it's salty water that comes in. So she does everything she can. She's just a woman alone with 3 kids, no money, raising a wall made out of like tree trunks and whatever to keep the sea from coming. And it seems in many of those accounts, when you piece them together, that they were absolute tragedies in her life as a young kid. Her older brother was vicious and mean. A younger brother had some kind of brain, whatever it was. It was never diagnosed as anything, but was a bit more, was gentle and tortured by her older brother, who tortured her as well. The mom defended the older kid. It seems that there may have been some incestuous relationship between Marguerite and her younger brother. Actually, in this book, she doesn't even name them. She just says the young brother, the older brother. But actually, her younger brother was actually older than her. She was the youngest child, but she refers to him because he's the youngest. And that she deals through all this, she survives all this, by escaping into books and reading. And she is a really good student, the child of a mathematics professor and of institutrice, actually just spent all of her youth in books, in literature. And her mother is playing the piano for silent films. So obviously in movies and in books. So every night she's seeing movies as well. And I think that comes through her, this book, very much.
The cinematic quality of it?
The musical quality of it, and the construction of a new narrative of self every night. I'm sure that she was there, and every night she was, every time she was reading a book, she was, you know, that character, and every night she was in that movie. And she grew up really wild, I mean, without any kind of like supervision in a way, because mm-hmm. her mom was working. I'm curious what you think about the issue of language. She grew up actually speaking Vietnamese fluently, and French was obviously the language of her parents, but she was growing up in the colony. And according to a prof at the Université Nationale de Hanoi in Vietnam, clearly speaks Vietnamese. He thinks that syntactically her writing actually owes something to Vietnamese. I mean, I'm curious because you also grew up, as I did, with a different language. And I think that also finding yourself between two different cultures and two different languages does shape your sense of self, that you can't help seeing yourself as a mutable story, and you know that it is part of what she's writing about here.
I'm sure that having to move through languages gives a child a sense of becoming a different person. You know, when you take on a language that is used at home versus used at school. But more than that, I'm sure that when you're poor, you become much more sort of a survivor, and so you become willing to be anybody, mm-hmm. right? And so that seems to me as pressing as the language issue, I would imagine. I'm curious to read a biography of her, because those details of setting up, of buying land, you know, that gets flooded, or putting up tree trunks to stop the water. All of those details sound wonderful. It would be wonderful to read a book that has.
But it's so actually in this book. Yeah, it's in the lover. Book, yeah. It is in there. And actually, some of what she lives through, it seems that in Escape, that's what's so interesting about this book, is that she actually tells so much. You know, it's not in a biography, but it is in this book. It's just you have to find it.
She just speaks so much of landscape and mm-hmm. of the house and the surrounding politics and economics.
And she talks about one happy moment of her youth is her mother takes Sam, her and the younger brother, out into the night to look at the
landscape. Sure, and like when she talks about the river flowing by and how the river's waters mm-hmm. are not the ones that flow into the in the rice paddies. Mm-hmm. So all of this exists, right? All mm-hmm. of this exists within the text, right? But for me as a reader, having not lived her life and not knowing anything about her, it is not material that is accessible to me.
It does ask a lot of you. You know, it does ask, it asks you to let there be space between like a full, you know, it's not an autobiography, you know, but I think that is a tension that you have to sort of endure in it. It depends on sort of where you're coming to it. I remember reading Lauren Slater's Lying probably like 5 or 6 years ago, and it just infuriated me. I couldn't handle it. It was too vague. It's much like this book. But she admits, have you read that, Kate? I feel like you would have. It doesn't really matter which book it was. That's the one that I can think of that infuriated me when I first read it. Maybe infuriated is a strong word. But that book asked more of me than I was willing to give at that moment.
Yeah, and I think that Duras, it's about fragments of memory. It's not about a memory as linear or one's life is a coherent narrative. And I think the work of the Nouveau Roman, especially Duras and Sorot, is reacting against that idea of this very realistic narrative.
Well, it's reacting against the idea of a unitary character that
coherent.
That doesn't, and she's full of contradiction. And I mean, I can't help feeling that she really does capture the voice of a woman in the sense of, like, she has a mother that is both insane, like totally insane, to actually buy this land and then like try to like keep the sea at bay, and then later on succeed. Later on, actually opens up a school and is able to like feed her children, and is a no-nonsense peasant from the middle of France that somehow is surviving in the middle of Indochine. But she herself is, you know, sexually completely all over the map in her description of the sex scene with her lover, in her description of women, in her personal life. At the end of her life, her best friend was this much younger homosexual man that she finished her life with when she was an alcoholic, that couldn't possibly keep herself together. She would start her morning with two bottles of wine, vomit them, and then get drunk again, and then have him take notes.
Have you ever read her collection, Writing on Writing? It's a beautiful collection.
It really is.
But there's this moment where she's giving advice. She's always, when you're traveling, carry a bottle of whiskey in your suitcase and never show your books to your lovers.
Yes. Which I think is equally good advice.
I think
she is someone who is so contradicting herself all the time. And I think in each book, like, there's not any one book that follows the conventional, like you say, and at the end, you actually mentioned this, you said, and at the end, the lover is saying to her, I will love you forever, and that doesn't, to you, fit with the character. That's why I'm saying that she would be very happy.
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that what that person is saying, I don't know how to interpret, right?
It's ambiguous.
So I don't know how to interpret it. And to me, the language of the book suggests that I should take this seriously, take his claim seriously, that he actually feels these emotions. And I'm not sure whether what he's feeling is, hey, let me see if I can sleep with her again, right? That's my question. And so, it isn't the contradiction of a character.
When I read it, I actually don't think of him as a character as much as a figment of Marguerite Duras' imagination. So she is writing, she gets to have the last word. So she gives it the way she would have wanted to hear it. And there's very little to suggest that this has any bearing on any truth other than her, you know, what she wants to put at the end.
At this point, we would like to open up to you for any questions or conversation topics you might have.
There is a wonderful biography by Laura Adler, an authorized biography, and which goes into great detail. She had interviews, maybe it hasn't been translated from the French, but she had interviews with Duras before she died, and she had access to all her papers. And it's fascinating, especially that when she wrote, she constantly rewrote her stories. She went from her life, but she constantly rewrote them. And there is a great deal of detail about the actual story of what is known and other notes that Marguerite Duras had about the man that she did have a relationship with in China. But purely, clearly this was fiction. The same thing with her war years, how she constantly rewrote her life, and she did save her rations for her husband, but meanwhile she was with another lover at the time.
His best friend, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the book that took off. You know, like, this is the book that was such a good, like, seller everywhere.
And I think it's beautifully written, I find. And it stands on its own for what it is. But then to read The North China Lover, and I liked your comment about the love of her mother and the love of her brother, with whom Marguerite admitted she had an incestuous relationship with in childhood, and who she loved and mourned till he died young, and she mourned him. So there's a book that stands on its own, but there's also this reading about her life is fascinating. And in the part we heard about there is no center, there wasn't. It was a story that she wanted to tell whenever she was telling it at the time.
Hi. So because it's very cold here, right? It's very cold.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, it's very cold.
Sorry about that. Sorry. Because me, I just prefer to, because I'm going to talk about race. And because for me, you know, like, this book is about, like, a woman, like, crossing the race line for the sake of love, you know? And it's in the French context, it's even more like daring, because officially we don't speak about race in France. Race don't exist, you know, which is kind of strange. But I was thinking that in the US, do you have like, any idea of like a woman crossing the race line for the sake of love?
What's the question? Talking about race. I mean, there's
get the last one.
You know, Kate alluded to it. There's so many different things in the book, not just, actually, least of it, her relationship with her lover, although it's probably the biggest part of the movie, which I never saw, but in the books...
The movie is all the sex, I think, right? Yeah. Like, but it's just... And it was a controversy that the actors were act like the British news, like everyone thought the actors actually had sex in the movie, right? That's how I watched it.
I actually make a point of not watching films of books that I...
But
like
I saw, because, I mean, this was, yeah. You know, I was illiterate. Yeah.
But, you know, there is in all of her biographies elements that make one believe that young Marguerite prostituted herself to save her mother's crazy dream. You know, she basically had a liaison with a rich Chinese man because that brought money to the family, and she actually said at some point that Leo, which is the name of the guy, was paying the lenders, was financing in Syria a mill for her younger brother, a decoration workshop for older brother, and that the mother said, could you please not marry him? That would be better because he is an indigène. I mean, he's a native, so don't marry the native. But just take his money, and that will save the family. So all of this is in the book. I mean, the ambivalence, there's this extraordinary scene where she goes with her mother and brothers to the restaurant.
Their ambivalence towards him, but his family's ambivalence towards them as they're considered poor white as well.
Exactly, yeah. And he is Chinese in Indochina, so he is actually not an indigène, but he is another minority in what is now Vietnam. So yes, the issues are of race, and certainly, you know, she's a French family, but they are actually not much in France. It's school teachers or parents when they're in France. And then they go overseas to Indochine, and the father is made the head of the French schooling system for all of Indochina. So the first 7 years of her life, they live in a mansion. They have not just one boy, but they have plenty of servants, and they have an army of functionaries that defer to them. And then the father dies, and then they left, you know, they can't go back to France, where they don't have the money and they don't have the jobs there. So they have various positions as either the overlords or the poor white trash, you know, that the Chinese man, rich father, doesn't want his son to marry Marguerite because she's not of a high enough echelon. So all of this are very interesting issues that, you know, it's always easier to see when it's a different culture than yours. So like here, it's pretty boldly described.
She's very explicitly engaging with this sort of despair over race and class. I mean, it's up to, you know, I guess theorists to see if she's doing it elegantly, but there's definitely, to me, such a melancholy over the women on the side of the road, you know, the sort of these experiences of poverty she's observing, the sense of exile and feeling ostracized. And it reminded me a lot reading at this time of Jean Rhys's White Sargasso Sea. Again, the mother and the daughter, the sense of being marooned, the sense of seeming like trash when you once were had more wealth and
and the ambivalence, I mean, of her social standing. You know, she has similar experiences with her husband. During World War II, she's actually at some point corralled by some friends into the Résistance, and one of her resistant friends is François Mitterrand, who then becomes the president of France, and she stays friends with him, but then her husband is actually arrested for being a Jew and sent to Dachau, I think. And she is by then pretty much separated from him, but living with his best friend. And then she keeps her ration to try to... She goes to Germany to try to get him liberated when the liberation happens. So she's quite heroic on so many fronts. But then it's true that she also they remain friends, so it's all good. They live together. She keeps her married name, since they don't have a divorce. But she's with the other man, and he is the third of the threesome. I mean, it's quite complicated. Her love
life. It's like a soap opera.
Yeah, she has
three husbands. Days of Duraz.
And then the last lover is actually this man with whom she has no sexual relationship because he is homosexual. But who takes care of her and her legacy. There's so many different issues. Like, actually, Catherine had asked us to put together various topics, but there's way too many topics in that book.
To me, there's a lot of ideas in it that are... And reading it again this time, I was thinking so much of all these portraits that she drifts in and out of that have nothing to do with that specific time and context, have so much to do with identities, these sort of fractured identities during wartime.
Yes, she talks about a couple and how they were basically collaborationists with a Nazi. Because when she's writing, you know, so history has been rewritten in this clear black and white. So there were the good guys and the bad guys. And in Hiroshima, Mon Amour, that's also something that is very controversial, that basically there's a lot of consorting with the enemy. She's also a communist. We just abandoned the Communist Party. There's many of those issues that are actually addressed with that book, and they all are expressed through literature. So
the issue of race just reminded me that I'm curious to what extent you think beyond her life and autobiography. Of course, Vietnam was occupied by the Chinese for 1,000 years and then the French, and she's born in Saigon. Can this be political, the Chinese raping Vietnam. I mean, what can we do with that, the real political history of Vietnam vis-a-vis this memoir of sorts? I'm curious what you think about that.
It sort of refuses, I mean, as a document, as a text, it kind of refuses that reading a little bit. I mean, we haven't even touched on the kind of statutory rape vibe of it, and I don't really, I mean, you know.
And also the prostitution, really, like the idea that she's, that this young girl doesn't have that many options.
She doesn't have options, and I don't think that she's like instantly in love with this man. He's just kind of there, and she's there, and it's an option, and it's not so much a crossing the race line for love. It's more just kind of like, I have this, how she phrases it, I have this space for desire in me, and then there's this person here that grants entry into that space of myself. I can't remember the line in here also that she goes on. Oh, she says that she didn't, after she was with this man, she wasn't with anyone else for 2 years, but it wasn't fidelity to him, it was fidelity to herself. So, I'm sorry, political. Can it be political?
I don't think it's dogmatically, so.
It kind of refuses that reading in a way.
Well, I think that it's in there, and she definitely, having grown up, again, as a little barefoot kid with Vietnamese kids, she does talk about this, and our connection with the language and with the jungle, and how it was seen from her as a kid. Kids are not, have not assimilated yet. Like, she was hanging out with her friends, and then she gets separated as a young person, as like, no, the proper way to do things is the French way versus the Vietnamese way. And I think that there's a love for that. When she says we don't have seasons, we just have one long summer, there's a we in here that is part of her that she has to lose when she goes to Paris and the rest of her life is spent in Paris. But I agree with Catherine that you cannot reduce it to that. And what I find remarkable about the text, certainly in rereading it recently and rereading it again and again, is how many different classes you could teach on this. There's so many, but the one that I find interesting is you mentioned young women. You know, actually, I say, because now I'm not a young woman, I'm an old woman, but it really is a point where you worry very much when you're 15 about who you're going to be. And then when you get to be older, when she wrote this, she was much older. I think she had a sense that she was, you know, all of this. And it's very rich in terms of how many people can any one person be. And she will not let the movie or anybody just hold her down to just one aspect of herself. And that I find very admirable.
I was wondering, I was thinking when you guys were talking earlier about the book's sort of intentional disorganization in terms of time and even on the sentence level. And you guys were talking a little bit about whether or not the reader has to do more work to get into it and what that means. I wondered if you guys could talk a little bit about that in terms of the fact that the book moves between first person and second person sometimes, that she talks about the third person, she talks about the girl, which is herself, and then also from a first person point of view. And when I read the book, I found that to be so, that it did work very well and that it makes complete logical sense. And I know in Kate, in your novel, Green Girl, you talk to your main character as sort of yourself. And I wonder if you guys could talk about that perspective a little and whether or not it works or doesn't.
Well, in Green Girl, the narrator is a fictional character. So I think less intimate than what Darragh is performing, because I think Darragh is performing such this radical honesty. Although, of course, the narrator is fictional and is not exactly the author. But I love the movement to realizing that if she is writing of this girl of her past, that that girl is a fictional character. And I think the third person, the switch to the repetition, which is very film-like. I was kind of reminded of like Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard, watching the film of her childhood a little bit, but like, you know, being a brilliant writer. But this repetition of this 15 and a half year old girl and this image, it's very cinematic. So I think she kind of goes into director mode with that. And so, yeah, for me, I love that move. The shift is a little alienating. It is the sort of distancing that I think makes a lot of sense in terms of what she's, how she's constructing this character of a former self. But I mean, I love that. I love works that are fragmented and have ruptures to them. And there is a little bit of a theater that's happening, all these different masks and personas and multiplicities of selves in it. But yeah, I think it's organic, but to me it's not disorganized. The flow is quite
there's an integrity to it still. Yeah. I would say though that I don't like the third person. I think it's one of the imperfections of the book, but if I can't find an imperfection in a book, then I don't feel like I'm reading it closely enough. So it's just one of the things I don't love about it. Also, because often she is talking in first person about those same memories. It shifts back and forth. It seems like it's just kind of just one of the imperfections that sort of came out, and then she read it and was like, well, that's how it's going to be. And that's fine with me. I didn't write it. I don't have to agree with every choice, but I can accept it.
For me, it works because it actually always, it doesn't let you fall into the complacent mode of like, okay, I get it. I'm in the story and the writer is in charge and I'm just following wherever she's leading. Like this is a sentence that she has in the middle of the book, which I don't, maybe... Dans les histoires de mes livres qui se rapportent à mon enfance, je ne sais plus tout à coup ce que j'ai évité de dire, ce que j'ai dit. Je crois avoir dit l'amour qu'on portait à notre mère, mais je ne sais pas si j'ai dit la haine que l'on lui portait aussi et l'amour qu'on se portait les uns les autres, etc., etc., etc. But she's saying in the stories of my books that are about my youth, I don't know, all of a sudden I can't remember what I have avoided saying, what have I said. I think I talked about the loves that we had for our mother, but I don't know if I ever talked about the hatreds that we had for her as well, and the loves that we had for each other, and the hatred also, so terrible. And it feels like actually being in a room with someone after like three glasses of wine, and then she is actually talking to you in a way that is so vivid that is seldom achieved. Again, to me there's that sense of like she will not let you, the reader, put her on that pedestal of the writer and have the authority. She keeps undermining her authority. And it's not chaotic and it's not disorganized and it's not, it's not a mistake that she shifts those voices, is that every time you feel like you're in that kind of like passive mode, she changes gear and makes you aware that you are reading a writer. Like Raymond Queneau was her editor, and it's something that I think was... really important to her writing and being a writer. It's essential to her, even though she also made movies. And he said to her, after reading the first text, by saying, Madame, vous êtes un écrivain. And I think she really wanted to earn that label.
Nathalie Sereau does this too in her book, Enfance, Childhood, where it is a sort of interrogating voice at the opening of it. So this is also specific with the writers that she was working with.
looking forward to reading Mr. Sharma's book, because I would imagine, and it's very, very different from this book. Am I right, Mr. Sharma?
It's different.
Yeah. In what way?
Yeah. It's the for me, writers rarely remain on a pedestal, right? It's like it's very hard to retain respect, you know, and so the challenge is not the issue is not sort of stepping off the pedestal, but desperately trying to remain on the pedestal. You know, it's so hard to be competent, right? And so for me, that's a lot of it. Like I think that a lot of these things which are dismissed are hard to do. They're worth doing, and I'm not sure whether, you know, I read this book as a work of fiction. When she said, "Oh, I don't know if I've written this thing before in my other books." First, I don't know whether she has written any other books, right? Whether this is just the claim of the narrator. And then two, you know, I'm willing to accept the fact that earlier when she claims she's an alcoholic, she is an alcoholic. And this is just sort of some rambling incoherence of like, I don't want to bother go looking it up. So I'm going to hold forth and continue. But again, I don't know. I mean, this is... That was my experience of it. You know, everybody experiences these books in different ways.
I mean, I certainly you're very articulate in your reading of this book. And again, I think that it would have pleased her because you a few times mentioned how it doesn't follow the traditional structure. And it's true what Kate was saying, that it was part of her intent to not give you a conventional narrative with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a set of characters going through the transformation, and to surprise you with the writing every time, to use it, to not use writing in a conventional way to tell a new story, but to also... explore new ways of doing books, including books that could not be self-contained works, you know, that would be in dialogue with the character. But obviously she succeeded.
Well, I mean, it's also a very existential novel. So I would, in terms of that it's ramblings, I think there is a sense of a theater of a mind, and we could situate this like Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, or, you know, many other works which have this sense of a monologue. So there is this idea of this monologue in the middle of the night, and she is purposely recreating that impression that you are with her thinking through these things, remembering these events.
You know, as soon as people began writing novels, as soon as they began writing short stories, they began trying to write them in different ways, right? And so the idea of trying to not write a traditional novel began probably with the second novel that was written, right? So that in itself is not some sort of revolutionary thing. So that again, that's the first part of thinking about it. Again, you know, everybody has a different experience of these books. And, you know, I don't know how much she was drinking when she was writing this book. Again,
how much was Hemingway drinking when he was writing?
But Hemingway basically stopped writing when he began drinking heavily, right? So
how much was Fitzgerald? Wasn't he drinking a lot?
But when you look at when you look at any of these writers, right? When you look at Fitzgerald, when you look at Hemingway, when you look at their careers, they basically stopped being able to produce coherent works when they began to write excessively, when they began to drink excessively. So when you look at the last 7 or 8 years of Hemingway's writing, almost none of it was publishable until editors went in and began cutting it up. When you look at the last 7 or 8 years of Fitzgerald's writing, you have the same issue that he wasn't able to publish in the same magazines that he used to publish in. When you look at, what was it, not the... the last tycoon, not the last tycoon, same issues. So again, I'm not, look, everybody has, I personally believe that alcoholism is a real thing and has a real effect on the brain of a writer or on the brain of anybody else. That is all aside, right?
Yeah, but she actually talks about this in the book. She talks about her desire to for death, à mourir, à en mourir. That's how she describes pleasure. She deals with her death wish in the book. This actually was written 2 years after she went through a massive detox. And by, I think, for some reason, life-threatening detox. I mean, it was she felt that totally changed her. So at that moment when she's doing that book, it's re-owning her life and the ways that she is, and certainly E.M. Sioran say every book is a postponed suicide. This book is a postponed suicide in terms of putting together her thoughts rather than drinking herself to oblivion.
Francoise, you mentioned earlier that she was part of the tradition of the Nouveau Roman, these other authors, and she's being edited by the founder of the Lipo. And I was wondering, was she in touch with these writers? Did she conceive of herself as a writer, as part of a movement? Did she see them as fellow travelers in this way? Or did she see herself outside?
She saw herself outside, but as allied with those people. She loved Queneau. I mean, Raymond Queneau was really important to her because of that trust that he gave her of Madame, vous êtes un écrivain. Nathalie Sarraute and Rob Grier and Michel Buteau were closer with each other, were more of a movement, and she was a bit on the fringe. She pretty much made enemies with just about anybody that she came close to. She worked with Alain René on Hiroshima, Mon Amour. But, you know, it's in the book also how, you know, like the being in the crowd and outside of the crowd, like being like the good guys, the bad guys. She belonged to the Communist Party and then quit it and denounced it ceaselessly. She said that she was a communist at heart, which was something that nobody in the Communist Party could possibly understand what it was to be a true communist. So she's not much of of a group member of any group.
My question, I think, is sort of more about the woman than the book, maybe. But I think Françoise mentioned earlier that a lot of the books really repeat the same types of topics over and over again. I read 6 of her books as part of a class in French in college, and honestly, they all kind of have flow together. Why do people write the same things, the same types of things over and over again? Whether it's about your mother purchasing, you know, some land that was poorly chosen, or in a different book, I forgot which one, a woman chooses the wrong diamond, the less valuable diamond with a choice between two. It's probably because it's something that the author can't quite wrap her head around about her life, and that she just has to, she keeps exploring the same things again. So I don't want to presume that she was writing to sort of figure things out, but given the sort of tragedy of her life overall, the question I always wonder is, do you think it helped?
Well, it seemed like a very specific understanding of writing, as if it was like catharsis or analysis, and then like once you finish with that topic, you can move on and, you know, go to topic number 2. I think, yes, writers have themes. I mean, I don't know how many Henry James books you've read, but yes, they all tend to blend together, and how many Dostoevsky books you've read. I mean, yes, they are Tolstoy. I mean, they are deep themes. The thing with Marguerite Duras is that there are so many topics that she touches upon between family, you know, brother, sister, mother, race, colonialism, writing, communism, and so on and so forth, and being a woman and being a woman writer, being a pretty woman, and actually being a woman that is proud of her face when it's full of wrinkles. She, you know, the seams of death, having lost her father when she was very young and feeling completely abandoned as a child and not having, like, a secure surrounding, having a mother that was kind of insane, a brother that was half retarded, another one who actually tortured her. Yeah, she had quite a lot to go to. As
were you asking whether or not the writing helped life, her life?
Well, there's that great quote by James Baldwin when he talks about literature, that for him, reading literature is discovering the consciousness of others who have felt exiled or marginalized. And I think it might not have helped her, but I think the type of literature she writes of this singular consciousness, and certainly some of her works are more fictional than others. They're not all, like Ravishing of Lil Stein is pretty fictional. In terms of it doesn't graft onto her autobiography so specifically. But I think, yeah, I mean, certainly she's a writer of obsession and circling, but I think the real question is those who read her, who feel a sort of identification with that consciousness, I think it might help them, potentially.
And I haven't seen the movies that she directed, but I was talking to Richard Brody with one of the film critics for The New Yorker, and loves Marguerite Duras, and loves Marguerite Duras' films, and he's seen them all. And they're evidently not that easy to get, but as far as Richard is concerned, she's a very talented filmmaker. That was the medium in which she...
Just getting back to the enigma, is not her enigma, but I just find that fascinating. And then you compare the her language. And then you compare it to Eliot's gorgeous, gorgeous language. My question to you would be, is it not earned, Duras is not earned, because you have not been brought in emotionally involved, you're not involved, it's too vague. Eliot is so sensual, you are in, you're there. Could you explain just a little bit more?
I think that... other people would say that she's very sensual and so she's compelling. For me, I feel like I sort of see what she's doing and I've seen it done before, right? And what's being done isn't... I don't know. I mean, I'm reading, I see what she's doing as to how to generate mystery, right? I'm going to make the sentence a little bit weird so it doesn't make sense, so it creates a sense of mystery. And I, you know, honestly, I feel like I've seen that done before, but more than that, I've seen it done before, and more than that, my preference, right, is sort of, you know, Shakespeare's claim or Shakespeare's demand, more matter, more matter. And so that's sort of my preference as a reader and as a writer. I also think that, you know, and F. Scott Fitzgerald said that, you know, a book must demand attention. You know, it must command us. And for me, the sentences here, don't command me. The sentences here, I'm not talking about Duras. I don't know who Duras is. You know, I don't know what the link between her. her personal life and this book is. I haven't read the other books. I'm only talking about, I don't know what the sentences are in French. I'm just talking about my experience here with these sentences.
It's possible that culturally, France is a culture that is very, very, where books are very important and authors are as well known or more well known than movie stars and read by large numbers of people. I think, like, you know, print runs in France, which is one fifth the size in terms of population, they're probably as big as they are in America. So you'd have to multiply by five here to get that kind of attentiveness. And it is not just Marguerite Duras, she's not singular in terms of spreading herself over more than one book and also being someone who has a voice, and the voice can exist outside of that one book. Like, you are talking about how, you know, when you have only read this and at the end it doesn't give you what you expected, that I don't think that was ever the intent, that that one book would ever really exist on its own as the only thing that she would have said.
So, but to some extent, we hope that a book stands on its own 2 feet, right?
I think this might be a good place to end. I would say this book and Marguerite Duras' life have commanded our attention tonight. I've thoroughly enjoyed this fascinating conversation among our group and among all of you. So thank you so much for coming.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.